Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1072, Julian Winspence with the Snake in Ukraine. This is being recorded on May 21st of the year 2019. This program is a direct continuation of what we went over in For the Record 1071. The reference to doing Winspence with the Snake is my, by now, very well-worn sense of humor. The reference is to the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, which we will get to, in which the Third Reich goes underground, builds up its economic potential, buys into the opinion-forming media, and eventually following a Nazi coup, it rehabilitates the Third Reich from a journalistic and historical perspective. Eventually, the Third Reich and the SS become heroes, and the Allies and the Jews are the villains. That sort of fundamental revisionism is going on in Ukraine, elsewhere as well. The Baltic states are particularly aggrieved in that regard, or beset in that regard. In our last program, we noted how on the 75th anniversary of Axis collaborator and kingpin, Subhas Chandra Bose's declaration of a, quote, independent, unquote, Indian territory in the Nicobar and Andaman Islands, this in 1943, when they were occupied by the Japanese, with whom Subhas Chandra Bose was allied. Narendra Modi of India fused, basically, Bosean fascism with the Hindutva fascism that he has made his trademark in India. Modi is on track to win a second 5-year term. There is, although the New York Times is in full Warren Commission mode and has been for some time, full Warren Report mode. They published the Warren Report. There is a reasonable article in today's New York Times, at least the Western edition, talking about Moby and how he fits the mode of what the New York Times and everyone else is calling populists around the world. It is one of the euphemisms for fascism, and Narendra Modi has now fused his Hindutva fascism, his Hindu nationalist fascism, which, as fascist movements generally do, demonizes the other. In the case of Hindutva fascism, they demonize Muslims. Modi took the 75th anniversary of Subhas Chandra Bose's Declaration of Independence in the Andaman Islands under Japanese occupation to not only rename some of the islands after Bose, but also to issue a stamp, a coin, and to christen the beginning of a university named after Subhas Chandra Bose. Also, we have talked about, in that same program, we noted that in the summer of 2018, there was an official celebration of the 75th anniversary of the founding of the 14th Waffen-SS, or Galician Division. In the written description for the Record 1071, there is a large, full-color picture of this official celebration of the founding of a Waffen-SS division, and I think those who find my analysis far-fetched might want to take a look at that. If it seems ridiculous that the snake could be walked, that Serpent's Walk could take place, well, just take a look at what is going on in Ukraine. We're going to be talking about that and other things in this and our next program as well. Let me plunge right in. We are going to continue with a reading of an article from The Nation magazine of February 22nd, 2019. This is by Liv Glinkin, G-O-L-I-N-K-I-N, from The Nation magazine, again, of 2/22/2019. Neo-Nazis and the far right are on the march in Ukraine. And this talks about the outright Nazi elements that are not only revising history in a pro-Nazi fashion, a serpent's walk type fashion, but the fact that they are part of the government and have been manifesting in that regard. Skipping down and reviewing a section from the last program by way of overlap and continuity, this section called Anti-Semitism. I'm telling you one more time, go to hell, kikes. The Ukrainian people, have had it to hear with you, unquote. This a quote from Security Services Reserve General Vasily Vasily Volk, V-O-V-K, from May 11th of 2017. What this article on Mr. Glinkin does not mention is something we have spoken about in the past, which is that Mr. Volk, or V-O-V-K, was also in charge of the, quote, investigation, unquote, of the shootdown of Malaysian Airlines Flight MH17. That appears to have been the work of Ukrainian forces, not Russia, but that provocation and resulting misinformation has become one of the many features of the stunning anti-Russian propaganda tsunami to which we have been treated. I would also note, because this section of the article talks about the Israeli government's objection to the anti-Semitism, which is now de rigueur in Ukraine, that not only did Benjamin Netanyahu host Petro Poroshenko, who has presided over this as president of Ukraine, although he is no longer in charge of Ukraine, but Netanyahu himself is the son of Benzion Netanyahu, the personal secretary of Vladimir Yabotinsky, head of the Beitar, one of the fascist, the most important of the fascist elements within the Zionist movement. And Yabotinsky was an ally of Semyon Petliura, a pogromist butcher and early Ukrainian fascist, to whom statues are being erected in Ukraine. Netanyahu did not object to that. Continuing with this section about anti-Semitism in the current Ukraine. Unsurprisingly, government-led glorification of Holocaust perpetrators was a green light for other forms of anti-Semitism. The past 3 years saw an explosion of swastikas and SS wounds on city streets, death threats, and vandalism of Holocaust memorials, Jewish centers, cemeteries, tombs, and places of worship, all of which led Israel to take the unusual step of publicly urging Kiev to address the epidemic. Public officials make anti-Semitic threats with no repercussions. These include a security services general promising to eliminate the Zhidi, a slur equivalent to kikes. That was the aforementioned Vasily Volk, again, who was in charge of the, quote, investigation, unquote, of the shootdown of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. A parliament deputy going off on an anti-Semitic rant on television. A far-right politician lamenting Hitler didn't finish off the Jews. And an ultra-nationalist leader vowing to cleanse Odessa of Zhivi. For the first few years after Maidan, Jewish organizations largely refrained from criticizing Ukraine, perhaps in the hope Kiev would address the issue on its own. But by 2018, the increasing frequency of anti-Semitic incidents led Jewish groups to break their silence. Last year, the Israeli government's annual report on anti-Semitism heavily featured Ukraine, which had more incidents than all post-Soviet states combined. The World Jewish Congress, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and 57 members of the U.S. Congress all vociferously condemned Kiev's Nazi glorification and the concomitant anti-Semitism. Ukrainian Jewish leaders are also speaking out. In 2017, the director of one of Ukraine's largest Jewish organizations published a New York Times op-ed urging the West to address Kiev's whitewashing. Last year, 41 Ukrainian Jewish leaders denounced the growth of anti-Semitism, and that is especially telling given that many Ukrainian Jewish leaders supported the Maidan uprising. None of these concerns have been addressed in any way. The next section of Lev Glinka's article is Roma pogroms. And by the way, this, like the other topics here, are things we have covered in the past. It is relatively unusual for us to see all of these topics covered in and with linked documentation in a single article. That is why I am reading this as something of a synoptic presentation of the things we have spoken about in connection with Ukraine.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
From The Guardian of August 27th of 2018, quoting some Ukrainian Roma, that is a formal term for Gypsy, Roma and Sinti are the two major divisions of what we call, the people we call, quote, Gypsies, unquote, an unflattering term. Quote, they wanted to kill us. Masked neo-fascists strike fear into Ukraine's Roma. Ukraine's far right has resisted carrying out outright attacks on Jews. Other vulnerable groups had not been so lucky. Last spring, a lethal wave of anti-Roma pogroms swept through Ukraine with at least 6 attacks in 2 months. Footage from the pogroms evokes the 1930s. Armed thugs attack women and children while raising their camps. At least one man was killed, while others, including a child, were stabbed. Two gangs behind the attacks, C-14 or Combat 14, and the National Druzhina, D-R-U-Z-H-I-N-A, felt comfortable enough to proudly post pogrom videos on social media. That is not surprising, considering that the National Druzhina is part of Azov, while the neo-Nazi C-14 receives government funding for, quote, educational, unquote, programs. Last October, C-14 leader Serhiy Bondar, S-E-R-H-I-Y, last name capital B-O-N-D-A-R, was welcomed at America House Kiev, a center run by the U.S. government. More about this later. Appeals from international organizations and the U.S. Embassy fell on deaf ears. Months after the U.N. demanded Kiev end systematic persecution of the Roma, a human rights group reported that Combat 14 were allegedly intimidating Roma in a joint patrol with the Kiev police. I would add that the National Druzhina and a similar militia from C-14 had been granted police powers in Ukraine in something like 31 different cities, including Kiev, the capital. And the next section concerns gay and women's rights. Quote, it's even worse than before, unquote, how the revolution of dignity, unquote, failed LGBT Ukrainians, unquote. This is from Radio for Europe on November 21st of 2018. I would add here quickly before we proceed that negative coverage, accurate coverage of the advent of fascism in Ukraine is generally dismissed as Russian propaganda, and those who have the courage and the integrity to report on what is really going on are routinely dismissed as Kremlin dupes or agents of Russian disinformation. I wonder how they are going to dismiss Radio Free Europe as a Russian propaganda vehicle or dupes of the Kremlin. I'm sure they will find a way. Continuing. In 2016, after pressure from the U.S. Congress, the Kiev government began providing security for the annual Kiev Pride Parade. However, this increasingly looks like a Potemkin affair. 2 hours of protection with widespread attacks on LGBT individuals and gatherings during the rest of the year. Nationalist groups had targeted LGBT meetings with impunity, going so far as to shut down an event hosted by Amnesty International, as well as assaulting a Western journalist at a transgender rights rally. Women's rights marches have also been targeted, including brazen attacks in March. And next, attacks on the media. I would add that something very similar is going on in India, and one of the connecting elements is Pierre Omidyar, who not only helped to bring to power the OUMB successor fascists in Ukraine, but Narendra Modi and his BJP/RSS Hindutva fascists in India. And journalists and political critics, dissenters, are being massacred and intimidated in both countries. In a section of Galenkin's article called Attacks on Press, quote, "The Committee to Protect Journalists condemns a Ukrainian law enforcement raid at the Kiev offices of Media Holding Vesti," that's V-E-S-T-I. "More than a dozen masked officers ripped open doors with crowbars, seized property, and fired tear gas in the offices." This from the Committee to Protect Journalists of February 9th of 2018. In May of 2016, Mirot Voretz, M-Y-R-O-T-V-O-R-E-T-S, an ultra-nationalist website with links to the government, published the personal data of thousands of journalists who had obtained accreditation from Russia-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine. Mirot Voretz labeled the journalists, quote, "terrorist collaborators," unquote. A government-type website declaring open season on journalists would be dangerous anywhere, but it is especially so in Ukraine, which has a disturbing track record of journalist assassinations. This includes Olesh Buzina, B-U-Z-I-N-A, gunned down in 2015, and Pavel Sheremet, S-H-E-R-E-M-E-T, assassinated by car bomb a year later. The Mirot Voretz doxing was denounced by Western reporters, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and ambassadors from the G7 nations. In response, Kiev officials, including Interior Minister Arsen Avakov, who, by the way, has presided over the Azov Battalion, praised the site, quote, "This is your choice to cooperate with occupying forces," Avakov told journalists while posting, "I support Mirot Voretz on Facebook. Mirot Voretz remains operational today." Last fall brought another attack on the media, this time using the courts. The Prosecutor General's office was granted a warrant to seize records of Radio Free Europe anti-corruption reporter Nathalie Sedletska, S-E-D-L-E-T-S-K-A. A Radio Free Europe spokeswoman warned that Kiev's actions created, quote, "a chilling atmosphere for journalists," unquote, while Parliament Deputy Mustafa Nayem, N-A-Y-Y-E-M, called it, quote, "an example of creeping dictatorship," unquote. And the next section of Galenkin's article, we've reported on all of this, including what is about to follow, but I would note that there has been relatively little coverage of the open assault on Russian language in Ukraine, one of the major languages in Ukraine, which is, like quite a few other European countries, a multilingual nation. Among the factors that has led to the secessionist war in the eastern provinces of Ukraine is the suppression of the Russian language. That is the language spoken by those rebellious provinces. And the article continues, Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk also made a personal appeal to Russian-speaking Ukrainians, pledging to support a special status to the Russian language. This is a quote from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, April 24, 2014. Ukraine is extraordinarily multilingual. In addition to the millions of Russians Russian-speaking Eastern Ukrainians, there are areas where Hungarian, Romanian, and other tongues are prevalent. These languages were protected by a 2012 regional language law. The post-Maidan government alarmed Russian-speaking Ukrainians by attempting to annul that law. The U.S. State Department and Secretary of State John Kerry sought to assuage fears in 2014 by pledging that Kiev would protect the status of Russian. And note this, those promises came to naught. Just imagine, although the analogy is a poor one because there really is no historical antecedent, but imagine if parts of the American Southwest, say Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, and Southern California were reoccupied by Mexico, and one of the first things they did was to ban the speaking of English and the use of English in the schools and the media. That would not sit too well with folks down there. And the similar treatment of the Russian language in Ukraine, the eastern provinces in particular, where Russian is the main language, has not exactly set them to doing the varsity rag. Continuing. A 2017 law mandated that secondary education be conducted strictly in Ukrainian, which infuriated Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Greece. Several regions passed legislation banning the use of Russian in public life. Quotas enforced Ukrainian usage on TV and radio. This would be akin to Washington forcing Spanish-language media to broadcast mostly in English. And in February 2018, Ukraine's Supreme Court struck down the 2012 regional language law, the one John Kerry promised Eastern Ukrainians would stay in effect. Currently, Kiev is preparing to pass a draconian law that would mandate the use of Ukrainian in most aspects of public life. It's another example of Kiev alienating millions of its own citizens while claiming to embrace Western values. And the next section, the last section of the article, The Price of Willful Blindness. These examples are only a tiny fraction of Ukraine's slide toward intolerance. I love that. What we're talking about is the manifestation of fascism. Again, these examples are only a tiny fraction of Ukraine's slide toward intolerance, but they should be enough to point out the obvious. Washington's decision to ignore the proliferation of armed neo-Nazi groups in a highly unstable nation only led to them gaining more power. In essay after essay, D.C. foreign policy heads have either denied or outright celebrated the influence of Ukraine's far right. Curiously, the same analysts vociferously denounce rising nationalism in Hungary, Poland, and Italy as highly dangerous. Perhaps think tankers deluded themselves into thinking Kiev's far-right phase would tucker itself out. most likely, they simply embrace DC's go-to strategy of, quote, my enemy's enemy is my friend, unquote. Either way, the ramifications stretch far beyond Ukraine. America's backing of the Maidan uprising, along with the billions D.C. sinks into post-Maidan Kiev, make it clear. Starting February 2014, Ukraine became Washington's latest democracy-spreading project. What we permit in Ukraine sends a green light to others. By tolerating neo-Nazi gangs and battalions, state-led Holocaust distortion, and attacks on LGBT and the Roma, the U.S. is telling the rest of Europe, we're fine with this, unquote. The implications, especially at a time of global far-right revival, are profoundly disturbing. Well, indeed, and we have spoken about Ukraine at length and in detail for years, and there is effectively nothing new in this particular Nation article. However, it is relatively unusual to see all of these things covered in a single presentation, so I have read that. One of the things to note is the fundamental revision of history. And I talked about the Earth Island in our last program, and Pierre Omidyar. The Earth Island, of course, is that stretch of land going from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe and all of Asia. It has most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, most of the world's natural resources, including oil. And geopoliticians have long seen controlling the Earth Island as the key to world domination. As mentioned a short time ago, Pierre Omidyar, the journalistic hero to the unenlightened, shall we say, and clamoring masses of the so-called progressive sector for his launching of The Intercept, in fact, has collaborated with, among the other institutions, the Agency for International Development and the National Endowment for Democracy, both of those cat's paws for U.S. intelligence, to not only bring the OUND successor fascists to power in Ukraine, but also, as mentioned, Narendra Modi and his BJP/RSS Hindutva fascists to power in India. In both countries, minorities are being persecuted. There are pogroms, gypsies and others in Roma and others in Ukraine, and Muslims by and large, and Dalits to an extent, untouchables in India. Political dissidents and journalists are being outright intimidated or even murdered in both countries. And yet, despite the fact that he launched both two fascist regimes which are lethally inimical to free speech, Pierre Omidyar remains an icon of journalistic integrity to the so-called progressive sector, which is grotesque, frankly. Again, the book Serpent's Walk, published by National Vanguard Books, the publisher, by the way, of the Turner Diaries. I have spoken about that book many times in the past. I think it is far more than the novel it purports to be. I think it is, in fact, a blueprint and a manifesto for what is going to come. It is authored by someone who writes under the name Randolph D. Calverhall, C-A-L-V-E-R-H-A-L-L, and a couple of excerpts from the back cover of Serpent's Walk. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of their tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and equality, unquote. Just take a look at what is going on in the U.S. under Donald Trump.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Excerpt from Serpent's Walk. This is a conversation between two mercenaries, both of them converts to the Nazi cause. One of them is Lessing, L-E-S-S-I-N-G, and the other is Wrench, W-R-E-N-C-H. The SS, what was left of it, had business objectives before and during World War II. When the war was lost, they just kept on, but from other places. Bogota, of course in Colombia, Asunción, Paraguay, Buenos Aires, Argentina, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, Mexico City, Colombo, Sri Lanka, Damascus, Syria, Dhaka, you name it. They realized that the world is heading toward a corporocracy. 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. We, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we are slowly gaining. About 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a supercorp that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly, not with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly, one huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but a little so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. And still more from Serpent's Walk. Hell, if you can con Granny into buying sugar turds instead of brand farts, then why can't you swing public opinion over to a cause as vital and important as ours? In any case, we're slowly replacing those negative images with others. The good bad guy routine. What do you think of Jesse James, John Dillinger, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan? The reality may have been rough, but there's a sort of glitter about most of those dudes. Mean honchos, but respectable. It's all how you package it. Opinion is a goddamn commodity. It works with anybody. Give it time. Aside from the media, we've been buying up private schools and helping some public ones through philanthropic foundations and working on the churches and the born-agains. Indeed, as he says, hell, if you can con Grammy into buying sugar turds instead of brand farts, then why can't you sling public opinion over to a cause as vital and important as ours? And that is indeed what is happening no place more so than Ukraine. It's happening in India as well. I noted in, for the record, 1071, as well as in a Food for Thought post, the revision of Indian history, and now it is Subhas Chandra Bose, the Duce of Bengal, as he was known, who is being portrayed as India's liberator. And this sort of thing is going on in the U.S. as well. In a past program, we have noted that in Baraboo, Wisconsin, that's B-A-R-A-B-O-O, there was a photograph of the junior prom at a high school there, and the gentlemen in attendance there are all giving the Nazi salute. I would note that the sort of historical revisionism that is going on in Ukraine is going on in the U.S. as well. Edward Dolinsky, D-O-L-I-N-S-K-Y, who is a Ukrainian Jewish leader, noted in his, I guess this is Facebook, perhaps Twitter. Anyway, on his social media page, he noted that at a Ukrainian youth union summer camp in that very same town, Baraboo, Wisconsin, they have erected monuments in honor of Simon Petlura and Roman Shukhevich and Stefan Bandera. Petlura, the aforementioned early Ukrainian fascist and pogromist in the immediate post-World War I period. Roman Shukhevich, head of the UPA, the fellow whose troops basically as members of the Einsatzgruppe and Nachtigall liquidated the ghetto in Lvov in Ukraine in 1941, and there was a festival celebrating Shukhevich called Shukhevich Fest on the anniversary of that pogrom. Stefan Bandera, of course, the head of the OUNB, and his protege, Yaroslav Stetsko, was the fellow who implemented Nazi-style ethnic cleansing in Ukraine. He, too, is a hero to the contemporary Ukrainians. One of the things that is not mentioned in the Lev Glinka article and that gets no mention in those very few media sources that are willing to face up to what is happening in Ukraine is the fact that the OUNB and the UPA and related elements are in power in Ukraine and glorified there because they are not only, they are part of the Ukrainian government, but they are part of the Ukrainian government as a result of the Maidan coup, and in no small measure that was the work of Paul Manafort, as we have looked at in For the Record 1082, 1008, 1022, and 1023. And beyond that, the OUNB-related elements are part of the Ukrainian government because they are part of our government. And they are part of our government because they were part of the Third Reich's government.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
And For the Record program number 1058, 59, and 60, we looked at the coalescence of what I termed the Christian West. The Christian West is a Hitlerless Reich that was joined on, it was proposed by both Western intelligence agents like Alan Dulles and William Donovan, and some of their SS counterparts like Walter Schellenberg, and the go-between, among the major go-betweens was Prince Max Egon von Hohenlohe, who married into the Habsburg dynasty. Although it was dealt with as a contingency arrangement, in fact, the Christian West actually took place. So we've looked at that in For the Record, actually in AFA program number 37, How the U.S. Lost the Second World War. And we came back to it in a big way in For the Record 1009 and the aforementioned 1058, 59, and 60. In the description for the record number 1000 and for AFA 37, excuse me, we talked about the Christian West. And again, as part of the coalescence of the Christian West, the Galen spy outfit was glommed onto the fledgling U.S. national security system in the post-World War II period, which basically fused the Nazi intelligence system and the SS in particular with the fledgling CIA. Reinhard Galen's dealings with the U.S. were approved not only by Nazi head of state Admiral Karl von Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as the head of the Third Reich, but also General Franz Halder, H-A-L-D-E-R, who was Galen's chief of staff. One of the key elements of the Galen organization was the OUNB and other Eastern European fascist groups, such as the Iron Guard, the Bulgarian National Front, the Croatian Ustashi, and others. The cement, the glue that kept them together, as we looked at in our series about socialists for Trump and Hitler, was the SS. And ultimately, that Galen subsidiary, the OUNB, the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and related groups, became a pivotal part of the Republican Party, the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Organization. The point being that the OUNB successor organizations are present in the Ukrainian government because they are present in the American government. And they were present in the, they have been present in the American government because they were part of the Third Reich's government, which was married to our national security establishment as part of the Christian West coalescence, I should say. Reviewing now from the description for AFA 37 about what the Christian West is. When it became clear that the armies of the Third Reich were going to be defeated, it opened secret negotiations with representatives from the Western Allies. Representatives on both sides belonged to the transatlantic financial and industrial fraternity that had actively supported fascism. The thrust of these negotiations was the establishment of the Christian West, viewed by the Nazis as a vehicle for surviving military defeat. The Christian West involved a Hitlerless Reich joining with the U.S., Britain, France, and other European nations in a transatlantic, pan-European, anti-Soviet alliance. In fact, the Christian West became a reality only after the cessation of hostilities. The denazification of Germany was aborted, although a few of the more obvious and obnoxious elements of Nazism were removed. Nazis were returned to power at virtually every level and in almost every capacity in the Federal Republic of Germany. And supplementing our discussion of the Christian West, again, in AFA 37, For the Record 1009, and then For the Record 1058, 59, and 60, in his text, American Swastika, by Charles Higham, Charles Higham, in 1985, related some key features of the Christian West negotiations. And what is striking, this again is Alan Dulles, who along with his brother, John Foster Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell, helped to cobble together the profound Western mechanism that facilitated investment in Third Reich industry. Alan Dulles was negotiating with the aforementioned Prince Max Eggen von Hohenlohe, who married into the Habsburgs and was acting as an emissary of Walter Schellenberg, head of the SD, which was in charge. That was foreign intelligence, not the SD, but he was in charge of foreign intelligence for the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, which was the SS intelligence service. Later, those negotiations were picked up by William Donovan and as part of the M plan. And in American Swastika, Charles Higham relates some key features of what was being said and what was being envisioned. And what is quite remarkable here is the fact, first of all, that Alan Dulles really was on exactly the same page as the Third Reich with regard to anti-Semitism and the liquidation of the Jews. Dulles, that is, proceeded to give Hohenlohe the plan for American military involvement in continental Europe, thereby betraying America's World War II plans. And he foreshadowed the Cold War. And also, Alan Dulles and the M plan of William Donovan saw, that was negotiated with Franz von Papen, they basically laid the plans for not only the strength, the economic strength of the post-World War II Germany, but also the plans for the EU as well. From American Swastika by Charles Higham. Dulles pressed ahead. He said that it would be unbearable for any decent European to think that the Jews might return someday and that there must be no toleration of a return of the Jewish power positions. He reiterated his desire for a greater European political federation and foresaw the federal Germany that in fact took place. Again, note this. He reiterated his desire for a greater European political federation and foresaw the federal Germany that in fact took place. Basically, this is 1942 and 1943, and the OSS, America's World War II Intelligence Service, and the predecessor of the CIA, its key officials are negotiating with the Nazi SS, and they are basically laying the template for the EU and for the post-war Federal Republic of Germany. Again, Dulles reiterated his desire for a greater European political federation and foresaw the Federal Germany that in fact took place. Dulles made the curious assertion that the Americans were only continuing the war to get rid of the Jews and that there were people in America who were intending to send the Jews to Africa. This was Hitler's dream, of course, that the Jews would go to Madagascar and stay there. Skipping down. Dulles now proceeded to supply Hohenlohe with dollops of secret intelligence, announcing that the U.S. Army would not land in Spain, but after conquering Tunisia in North Africa, would advance from Africa toward the Ploiești oil fields in Romania to cut off the German oil supplies. He said it was likely the Allies would land in Sicily to cut off Rommel and control Italy from there, and thus secure the advance in the Balkans. Having given virtually the entire battle plan for Europe, top secret at the time, to one of Germany's agents, Alan Dulles proceeded to the almost unnecessary reminder that he had very good relations with the Vatican. In other meetings, Dulles predicted that, quote, the next world war would be between the USA and the Soviet Union, unquote. although the U.S. and Soviet Union never went directly to war, this obviously is the Cold War that was being predicted by Dulles, again, in his negotiations with the SS in 1942 and 1943. Dulles obtained a great deal of information relating to Germany and plans for its reconstruction after the war. He then described a recent speech by Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels as, quote, a work of genius. I have rarely read a speech with such rational pleasure, unquote. In July of 1943, OSS Chief William Donovan and the OSS began to take matters into their own hands. No doubt inspired by the invigorating meeting in Switzerland, Donovan embarked on the so-called M Project, and the details of that. By now, the German, Franz von Papen, had read the details of the peace proposal on microfilm and learned that it was more or less on the same lines as the Dulles proposals. Germany would be set up as the dominating force in industry and agriculture in continental Europe, at the heart of a continental state run by Germany, the USA, and Great Britain as a focus of trade. And again, basically, the EU and the EMU. One more time. Germany would be set up as the dominating force in industry and agriculture in continental Europe, at the heart of a continental state run by Germany, the USA, and Great Britain as a focus of trade. What has happened since then is that basically the German faction has become the dominant faction in the international cartel community. That's actually redundant. I guess one could say that the Berlin Gang has achieved primacy over the Washington mob and the London Syndicate as the dominant element in the international cartels. The point being here that in these negotiations between Western intelligence and the SS in 1942 and 1943, during World War II, the plans for the post-war world were being hammered together, and they played out in that fashion. And it is also more than a little interesting to see not only the foreshadowing of the Cold War, but to see the extent to which Alan Dulles, and he made it clear that other members of the American power elite were on the same page, that how resonant they were with Nazi ideas. Said that Dulles made the assertion that Americans were only continuing the war to get rid of the Jews, and also describes a speech by Goebbels, a work of genius. I have rarely read a speech with such rational pleasure, unquote. The point being that this is how things were bound to wind up. The things that we are seeing now unfolding on the international stage were being set in place during World War II as a consummate act of treason by Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell, who, along with his brother John Foster Dulles, presided basically under the Eisenhower administration, in which Allen was head of the CIA and Foster Dulles was Secretary of State. We had a Sullivan and Cromwell government, and they presided over, among other things, the complete Nazification of America. It has taken a while to come above ground, but it is doing just exactly that, and it is happening all around the world. In our next program, we are going to once again take a look at what is going on in Ukraine and with the Azov Battalion. That is arguably the most important of the Nazi military formations in Ukraine. They are the parent organization of the aforementioned National Druzhina Militia, which has police powers in Kiev and some 30 other Ukrainian cities. And the Azov Battalion is being set up as something of a serpent's egg. We've talked about serpent's walk, something of a serpent's egg in which there is networking between the Azov people and Nazi and fascist elements from not only other places in Europe, but from around the world as well. We don't have much time to get into that here. But dipping our toe, so to speak, into material we will cover in our next program. This is from the intelligence report of the Southern Poverty Law Center from October 29th of 2018 by Brett Barouquere, Barouquere. Three members of Rise Above Movement arrested in California. Fourth sought as fugitive turns himself in. A violent white supremacist gang known as Rise Above Movement and two others traveled to Europe to celebrate Adolf Hitler's birthday and later met with a paramilitary chief there, federal prosecutors say. Robert Rundo, R-U-N-D-O, a 28-year-old Huntington Beach, California resident, 29-year-old Michael Paul Mazzellis, M-I-S-E-L-I-S, of Lawndale, California, and 25-year-old Benjamin Drake Bailey of Redondo Beach, went to Germany, Italy, and Ukraine in the spring of 2018, not only to celebrate, but also to meet with European white supremacist groups, prosecutors said in a criminal complaint against Rondo unsealed this week. FBI agents arrested Rundo on Sunday. That was Rundo, not Rondo. FBI agents arrested Rundo on Sunday at L.A. International Airport, said Catherine Gulotta, G-U-L-O-T-T-A, a spokesman for the agency in Los Angeles. He had been arrested in Central America before being returned to the U.S. Two others, 25-year-old Robert Bowman of Torrance, California, and 22-year-old Tyra Laube, L-A-U-B-E, of Redondo Beach, California, were arrested Wednesday. A fourth RAM member, 38-year-old Aaron Eason, E-A-S-O-N, of Anza, California, surrendered to the FBI over the weekend. The four are charged with a series of violent attacks during events in Huntington Beach, Berkeley, and San Bernardino, California, in 2017. Prosecutors said the four men used the Internet to coordinate combat training, recruit members, and organize riots. And it talks here about these groups networking in Europe with members of the Azov Battalion and other European fascist groups. And one of the things that I would note, and we're going to come to this, come back to this in our next program, there are indications that Brett Tarrant, T-A-R-R-A-N-T, he is the Australian national who went on a lethal shooting spree in New Zealand and killed a bunch of Muslims, shot up some mosques. He had apparently been in Ukraine and apparently been in touch with members of the Azov Battalion. More about this. There is an article from, again, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty from November 14th of 2018 by Christopher Miller. Azov, Ukraine's most prominent ultra-nationalist group, sets its sights on U.S. and Europe. And it talks about networking between, again, the RAM people and fascist elements in Ukraine, including elements associated with the Azov Battalion. And we will get to that, but Tarrant and other things in our next program. I will also note that in the recent Ukraine elections, the National Druzhina Militia, again an offshoot of the Azov Battalion, was initially at least given the powers of policing the polls. However, that is something we will cover in our next program. This concludes For the Record program number 1072. doing wind sprints with the snake in Ukraine. This is being recorded on May 21st of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.